You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
You know, as we try to build this big progressive governing majority and move forward, the big challenge is, you know, what is possible for us in the new century to do? We are facing a triple crisis: radical environmental destruction, radical social inequality, and deepening despair. If you want to know, how would you define the challenges on the front end of the new century? Radical social inequality, radical environmental destruction, and deepening despair. Is there a solution? Is there a single elegant solution to this incredible triple crisis? We want to make the argument, yes there is. We want to make the argument that a green growth economy with shared prosperity as a key value can restore hope. And so I want to lay out for you what we're trying to do in Northern California. I want to give you a sense of it, taste of it. I want to tell you why I think it's important and why I think it can work. And then I want to have a conversation with you about what's possible here for you, because this is such a beautiful community, Vancouver, with so much potential and so much promise. My hope is that some of these ideas will find a home here as well. So we're at the beginning of the third wave of environmentalism. The first wave, see, this is a pedagogical trick. I just want to just expose myself. By saying a third wave, then you're going to say, Jesus, what's the first one? And what's the second one? And I buy myself time, you see, to stuff in a whole bunch of other stuff. But, you know, can't get anything past you guys. So here's the deal. So what's the first one? The first wave is what we call the conservation wave. Really, the indigenous people were the first conservationists, so they should really be up here. But in the United States, Teddy Roosevelt and others, John Muir and others, said, hey, I've got a brilliant idea. I've got a great idea. Let's not pave the whole continent. How about that? Let's just not pave the whole thing and just sort of put, you know, golden arches all, you know, let's actually keep, you know, a tree. And, you know, it's such a radical idea, you know, and to launch a whole movement on that premise, and they were called the conservationists. And that is still an ongoing movement. It has its purpose. It's continuing to be a powerful force. But in the 60s, somebody named Rachel Carson wrote a book called Silent Spring. And what she was able to demonstrate through her book was that when you're talking about the environment and you're talking about industrial society, you aren't just talking about creeks and critters and birds and bees. You're also talking about human beings. That we're poisoning ourselves, that we're toxifying our own bodies. And so her work inaugurated this whole wave of regulation, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, et cetera. And that has been a powerful movement, and it's had its day. What we're saying is that there's now a third wave that's beginning. And this third wave lays the basis for a whole new politics of hope, opportunity, and possibility. The third wave is conservation of what we have, yes, plus regulation of bad stuff, regulation of the problem, yes, plus investment in the good stuff, investment in the solutions, investment in solar power, investment in hybrid technology, investment in biodiesel, investment in organic agriculture. Let's not just regulate the bad stuff, let's start investing in the good, in the positive. Once you are talking about a politics of investment, you are talking about a radically different politics. You're talking about a politics of hope and opportunity. To people who may not be aware of how big this sort of third wave of green economic development is, let me just show you a little stuff, some little stuff here. Impress you with my technological skill and savvy. This, I don't know if you can see this, this is Cameron, who is this? Somebody? Cameron Diaz, yeah, see, I'm cool. Cameron Diaz getting into her hybrid, that's George Clooney getting into his little electric car. That's Lori David, whose husband is the director of Seinfeld. This is eco-chic. And it's big. This past year, Vanity Fair did a whole green issue. That's Julia Roberts there, and Robert Kennedy Jr., Vice President Gore. Elle Magazine, the same month, came out with a green issue. Green is the new black. Wired Magazine came out with an issue. Popular Mechanics came out with an issue. Suddenly you had this huge explosion in the United States of consciousness about all these environmental solutions, and it hit the mainstream. Greenvertising was born, and all these big polluting companies started claiming that they too were environmentally positive. So this is a Go Yellow. Which one is that? That's GM. You've got Environmentology. I think that's Honda. Yeah, Honda. It's another Honda one. You've got big computer companies saying that they're green. Eco-Imagination, which is, I think, GE. This one I love. This one says, you can't read this. It says, corners and trees both deserve to be hugged. So again, I guess it is easy being green. You know, that's, if only, but this just gives you a sense. You say, well, that's just greenwashing, Van. I mean, this doesn't really signal any big change. I mean, it's just sort of a gimmick. Well, if you actually look at it, $238 billion economy that we're talking about here, and growing on a vertical. This is a huge sea shift in the U.S. economy as more and more consumers begin to rush to embrace cleaner, greener technology, healthier, more organic and natural foods and products, and this thing is growing on a vertical. Just to dig into it a little bit, clean tech. Clean tech is, solar stuff, less polluting technologies, et cetera. People were shocked in the United States last year to discover that when the venture capitalists start making their bets, clean tech was number 6, just behind telecommunications and healthcare last year. Where are the venture capitalists putting their money? Bill Gates came out and said, this is the big play for the next decade, clean tech. He put billions, others began to move, and people were stunned because this came out of nowhere. People were even more stunned at the end of the third quarter last year when clean tech passed IT in the United States. Now the number 3 and rising. By the end of the year, this may be the number 1 venture category. So again, the green economy is no longer the sort of fringe, marginal thing only for the truly initiated. This is a huge part of the U.S. economy and growing on a vertical. Just on the energy side alone, this is not, all the organic stuff or whatever, just energy alone. Biofuels, wind power, solar power, fuel cells. You put it all together, we're at about $40 billion right now. In 10 years, $167 billion is being projected to be spent on just the clean energy stuff alone. Okay? That is a huge, huge shift. When you're talking about $130 billion, we begin to ask a certain question. We've already seen something like this happen before in the United States. It was the Internet Revolution. And I don't know if you remember this, but as soon as the Internet Revolution happened, we spent about 10 years talking about the digital divide and who was being left out and who was being left behind. And, tell you the truth, I live in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley. When the internet bubble burst, I didn't see any black people crying. Okay? When the internet bubble burst, I didn't see any black people crying because we were never a part of it, right? I didn't see Latinos crying. I didn't see poor people crying because that whole thing came, and then when it burst, walking the Mission District, and you see these guys, their eyes are all wet and puffy. What's wrong with you? $5 million? You know, your bust is my wet dream. Can I have your $5 million? You're gonna cry like that about having $5 million? You know, so it was. I mean, that was how extreme this whole thing wound up. That you had people crying about only having $5 million, and we could barely make rent. So we don't want to do that again with the green economy. We want to make an argument. We want to say that those communities that were locked out of last century's pollution-based economy should be locked in to the new clean and green economy. Those communities that were locked out of the last century's pollution-based economy should be locked in to the new clean and green economy. We want to build a green economy that's strong enough to lift people out of poverty. Okay? We want to make sure that this new green wave of new products, new services, new technologies, this new green wave lifts all boats. The new green wave should lift all boats. That's what we want to do. And so to be specific about what our concerns are, we see three possible futures. Three possible futures. The first one is eco-apocalypse. That would be the bad one. That's, we just keep doing what we're doing. Turning living stuff into dead stuff at a faster and faster rate until we're gone. Suicide economy. We all know about that. That's why we're here. We don't want that. But there's a second possibility. Eco-apartheid. Eco-apartheid is a society in which you have ecological haves and ecological have-nots. You say, how could that be? We're all good liberals and progressives. How could we wind up with that? Come to the Bay Area. Right now. Anybody ever been to Marin County in the Bay Area? Anybody? You know what I'm talking about, right? It's lovely. It's lovely. They have organic tofu and hybrid this and solar panel that. And it's lovely. 15 minutes later in a car, you're in Oakland. Cancer clusters, asthma, pollution, eco-apartheid. Eco-apartheid. So we don't want that. We think that if we do this right, if we work together, if we think about it on the front end, we can avoid eco-apartheid and get to eco-equity. And eco-equity is a state where those communities that most need the clean and green technologies and the health benefits and the wealth benefits and the job benefits from this shift get those benefits. So let me just show you a quick grid. Help you visualize this. What we've been talking about so far has been the move from a gray economy to a green economy. A pollution-based economy, a gray economy, based on pollution, based on poison, based on extraction, to a green economy, based on sustainability. What people, and that's the conversation that's going on right now, Vanity Fair, the whole deal. What people aren't talking about is this other dimension, the rich to poor dimension. This is a dimension of class, of race, of access, of privilege, of opportunity. If you put that overlay, you see something that I think is very important. When affluent people talk about the gray economy, they talk about problems with the environment, they often will start off talking about spotted owls, the Arctic Circle, rainforests, polar bears, right? These are very important macro systems that they are moved to defend and that they are concerned about. Critical work, key work. But I'm going to tell you, if I go in my neighborhood talking about some polar bears, let's go save the polar bears, people in West Oakland are not trying to feel me. They're not hearing me at all. They'd be like, you know what? Good luck with your polar bears. I'm trying to get some food. Right? Good luck with your polar bears. I'm trying to get my son out of jail. So in low-income communities, in poor communities, when we talk about the environment, we talk about what? Asthma. We talk about cancer. We talk about people drowning. Katrina, people drowning as a result of global warming. Both of these are equally important, but there's a difference of emphasis. As we begin to move now into a green economy, we see a similar dynamic. Again, when we talk about the green economy for the affluent, again, solar panels, hybrid, organic agriculture, all that beautiful stuff. What does it mean? It means business opportunities for rich people, which is very important because rich people need to be shifting their money to positive things. It also means consumer choices for affluent people, which is very important because people need to be making wiser purchasing decisions. But what does the green economy mean for the poor? That's the question. In what way can the green economy be made relevant to the poor? We say that beyond just business opportunities for the rich, consumer choices for the affluent, the green economy can mean green-collar jobs for poor people, wealth-building opportunities for poor people, health improvement for poor people. And that if we take that approach, if we insist that that be included, then we can actually involve the majority of people in a green economy. We can get beyond the eco-elite and the eco-privileged and build a green economy strong enough to lift people out of poverty. This is a picture from West Oakland. It's the People's Grocery. It's a beautiful effort. It's a beautiful effort. These are just young people who got a biodiesel truck and who go out once a week to local organic farms and get food and bring it to the inner city, where we have no grocery stores, not a single grocery store for 30,000 people, only liquor stores. If you want food for your child, you go to the liquor store, there's a heat lamp where a piece of chicken's been sitting there for 2 days, that's dinner, unless you want to take 5 buses to go where they have grocery stores. These young people took a biodiesel bus and they're fixing that. There is a way for the green economy to make a difference for poor people, but we have to prioritize it. Having said that, when we talk about jobs, you say, oh, well, you know, are there any jobs? Well, we did a study in Los Angeles. In construction, utilities management, wholesale, manufacturing, and professional services, there are lots and lots of jobs. We were able to identify a potential of 2,500 new jobs in Los Angeles County alone in the green economy over the next 2 years. Okay? So there, it is possible to create jobs for poor people and also wealth building opportunities for poor people. We think it's important that we do that. Our two pieces that we're doing in Oakland, number one, for the first time, and some of you guys are in government, maybe you can beat us to the punch on this, we are on track to create in Oakland the first ever green enterprise zone, where we're going to designate industrial land in West Oakland and East Oakland and encourage green and clean industry to come to set up shop. We're going to give incentives. We're going to give subsidies and supports. We're going to get green scissors and cut the red tape to try to get folks to come to Oakland. And you say, well, that's great, but, you know, how are people going to get those jobs? Maybe, you know, you set it up. Well, we're going to create the first ever Green Jobs Corps. We've already got the community colleges in Oakland, the labor unions in Oakland, and the prison reentry groups agreeing for the first time to cooperate on a common project. And that common project is the Green Jobs Corps. We're going to be training urban youth to put up those solar panels. We're going to be training urban youth to retrofit buildings so they don't leak energy. We're going to be training urban youth to do organic gardening, organic agriculture and permaculture on rooftops and on abandoned and vacant lots so we can start moving toward food security and also giving young people dignified, meaningful work. This is the next step in sustainability, where we deeply embody the principle that we do not have any throwaway species, we do not have any throwaway resources, and we don't have any throwaway children either, that we want to start reaching out with this new project, with this new idea, that in order for us to make this U-turn in our economy, we're talking about thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of new jobs. We have the opportunity now to take kids who are in the back of the employment line for the old pollution-based economy, If we teach them how to double pane glass so that it's more energy efficient, you know what those kids are? They're glazers. They're glazers. They can join a union. If we teach kids how to take bamboo, which can be much more environmentally positive, because bamboo is a grass. It grows, you cut it, it grows back. You cut it, it grows back. Unlike a forest, it grows, you cut it, and it's cut. So if you teach these young people how to work with bamboo, which is now the whole slick thing, you know what they are? They're green collar carpenters. They can join a union. They can get a job, you see. This is a tremendously hopeful opportunity to solve a number of problems at the same time. And I want to tell you, for me, you've heard my philosophical, conceptual framework, which we think is pretty clever, and our policy agenda. But we're not doing it for philosophical reasons. And we're not doing it just because we want to have good policy and be smart policy people. The reason that we're doing what we're doing is right here. These are the children of West Oakland. I know these little guys very well. That one in the middle reminds me so much of my son. And when you love somebody, you don't have small dreams for them. These kids live in a neighborhood where 30 kids in a classroom, 6 books, no chalk. They live in a city that's willing, in a state that's willing to spend $160,000 a year to put them in jail, and less than $4,000 a year on them if they stay in school. That corner right back there, a week before we took that picture, was covered in flowers and balloons because another kid had gotten killed right there. It's gotten so that when 2 and 3 year old kids in West Oakland see flowers or balloons, they start crying because they assume it's another sidewalk memorial. They assume it's another funeral. It will not be very long before people come up to these little guys and they're going to give them some options. They're going to say, come with me. I got something for you to sell. I got something for you to do. And these little guys right here, who right now are so hopeful, are going to be jail fodder. And if we don't do something, the statistics say that one of them won't make it to 20. I want to be a part of a movement that says, you know what, we have a place for you too. I want to be a part of a movement that says, we have a place for you. We have a place for you. We have a job for you. We have a mission for you. We want you to be the people who do something that lets the air in our community get cleaner. We want you to help us help your little sister and brother throw that asthma inhaler in the recycling bin because the sky is clean and clear because of what you're doing. We want to tell these young people that we have a dream for you. What you can do, dignified work. We want you to put up a solar panel on your grandmama's house so she doesn't have to pay all her money to PG&E, that where utilities can start paying her. We want you to put your hands in the dirt and pull out food and sustenance and nourishment so that the people in this neighborhood don't have to eat how we eat and don't have to die early of preventable diseases and obesity and high blood pressure. You can do that. We need you. We love you. We respect you. Help us turn this community around. You see, that's what this green sustainability movement can do. It can save the planet, yeah, but it can save people's lives. It can give people meaning again. It can let us stand together, bring in the labor community, standing next to the business community. We're gonna put down this conflict for these children. And we'll hire you and we'll train you and we'll work together to put you in a dignified role. See, we have an opportunity to bring together folks who've never come together before. And why is that? It's because we live in a time where, for the first time in America, we've seen the end result of this sick, twisted, everybody for themselves, sink or swim ideology. And we saw it in the floodwaters of Katrina. That is the logical outcome. That is the logical outcome of a sink or swim philosophy, a free market evacuation plan, where if you have a car and a credit card, you can leave. And if you don't, you sink and drown with an American city. And people have looked down the long barrel of that, and people in the United States have said no. People in the United States have said no. And so what we are saying to the sustainability community is to honor the Katrina principle. Everything that we do from now on, let's put the most vulnerable in the center. Let's put the most needy people in the center. Let's ask the question, how do any of our enterprises, any of our efforts, create a pathway out of poverty for the most vulnerable? Create a place of shelter, a place of support for the people who need it the most. Those of you who have been on the front end, the front lines of the sustainability struggle, as business people, as politicians. 10 years ago, people laughed at you. 10 years ago, people said you were strange. But now, even Republicans are running on clean energy and energy independence. Why? Because the march has begun from the margin to the center for you. The march has begun from the margin to the center. There's only one question for you now, and it's a moral question. Who are you going to take with you, and who are you going to leave behind? Who are you going to take with you, and who are you going to leave behind? I beg you, as you begin your move forwards, take these young people with you. Take these young people with you, and let's begin to sing a new song. Thank you very much.